At times it can feel almost like needing to very, very cautiously, gently try to tame and come closer to a very wild animal in the child, because that's the level that they're functioning on. It's to do with fear and fight and flight, and you're another very frightening adult that's come into their life, and why should they trust you?
Hello and welcome to Mind in Mind, a new podcast series featuring interviews with the world's leading clinicians working in child mental health. My name is Jane O'Rourke. I'm a child, adolescent and family psychotherapist. And at Mind in Mind, we believe that all of us working with children need the wisest minds to guide us. Everyone featured here on Mind in Mind have spent their clinical lives honing their understanding of child and family life. We're bringing you innovators and leading thinkers, sharing what their experience has taught them about children's minds. At Mind in Mind, we're appropriately beginning our first interviews with whom we've called the Child Psychotherapy Pioneers, the founding greats of child psychotherapy. They've been working with children for decades and are responsible for establishing some of the first children's therapy services and developing theories and ideas which shape our clinical thinking today. Our second interview is with one of the great luminaries of child psychotherapy, Monica Laniardo. You could describe Monica's quest to how best treat severely traumatised children, and in particular fostered and adopted children, as a calling. Remarkably, at only the age of 19, she started working with children who'd been taken into care by social services. And her working life has since been devoted to helping them, either as a clinician or supervising psychotherapists who do. She trained at the Tavistock Clinic under the auspices of Matty Harris, who ran the child psychotherapy training then, as well as with other notable names, such as Iska Wittenberg, who we've got interviewed in the series as well, coming up in a few weeks' time, Isabel Menzies-Leith, and Frances Tustin. And yet, after a training which primarily focused on the theories of Melanie Klein, she began to forge her own theoretical pathway, drawing on a diverse range of psychoanalytic thinkers. A succession of books and papers focusing on the treatment of traumatised children have flowed over the years, including the invaluable Handbook of Child and Adolescent Psychotherapy, and most recently, Transforming Despair to Hope. As anyone who's worked with traumatised children will know, this work is at times harrowing, despairing and exhausting, making demands on us that at times feel unsustainable. And yet Monica Laniardo began telling me why hope is so important to maintain in our work with traumatised children.
Well, I think if you don't have a fundamentally optimistic outlook on life and on the strength of what I think of now as the life force, there's no point in intervening at all. You know, you see the recovery of people who have really lived through the most dreadful experiences and you marvel at them, but they manage still to find some joy and happiness in life. And I suppose it intrigued me to try and understand how people in the ordinary population, not the clinical population, how did they manage to find that hope? What sustained them and what should we be looking for in the clinical population?
I know from my work with fostered and adopted children how difficult this can be. What do you think it is in particular about this group of children that make them so difficult a challenge for us as child psychotherapists?
Well, their behaviour, for a start, is highly defensive and anti-relationship forming. So they don't want to form relationships with adults to start with because they've been so badly let down, disappointed, harmed by adults. So you start with that. And then you have a child who is often in full fight-flight mode. And that is the most fundamentally important dimension in the whole way in which they live their lives. So it takes, and their brains and their minds are scrambled and their bodies are scrambled because of early trauma. So at times it can feel almost like needing to very, very cautiously, gently try to tame and come closer to a very wild animal in the child, because that's the level that they're functioning on. It's to do with fear and fight and flight, and you're another very frightening adult that's come into their life, and why should they trust you? So plus the actual, when you do go further, their actual contents of their mind, such as they are, have been smashed to smithereens in many ways. It's a very basic rebuilding, restructuring kind of process that often needs to go on.
You talk about the extraordinary response that these very deprived children need. And you're very clear that actually, as child psychotherapists, we actually do need to give them that.
Well, I think they've been so deprived of ordinary human responses to their ordinary infantile childish needs. And I think that for us as clinicians to be in touch with really what hasn't happened in their lives is enormously painful. And I think for social workers and many other people working with these children, they need their professional defences because it's overwhelming and they're not necessarily helped enough in their training and beyond to be able to bear the pain that is being communicated to them through these very destructive and violent behaviours that the children show. Whereas we have been trained with that. I think our training in terms of particularly our own training psychoanalysis and analysis often after training, as well as the whole supervisory process, as well as the length of the training and the detail of the training, I think that enables us to be able to bear more pain, bear hearing about more pain, and therefore get closer to the child than many other professions can bear to do.
You've been working with traumatised children, in particular fostered and adopted children, for a very long time, since you were 19. What drew you to that work?
I think inherently I've always been very aware of how if you can help a troubled child or a child who's in pain, they may hopefully turn into a happier kind of adult. So that was a very broad part of it. And part of me thinks it was sort of by chance that I ended up working so much with fostered and adopted children. But there have been various points at which I had to make choices as to which direction I was going to go in. And this was the direction that I seemed to keep choosing. I mean, there were a lot of more ordinary neurotic children or children living with one parent, particularly I was working in a residential school in Scotland that I was working with as well. But they were also very severely traumatised in different ways. They still had the one parent, but there were terrible histories for many of those children. But I think the fostering and adoption really sort of came by chance because of a local social worker who was very aware of the impact on children moving from fostering to adoption and who asked me to see some of the children she was working with. So that was by chance. But then I became absolutely, really, I found it extraordinary to try to make sense of what these children were going through. And that's there in these case histories. You know, the case history of Sammy was the first one. And I learned so much about him. And I, not just about him, but about the whole process. And then I found myself writing about this from so many different angles that I still get confused now as to what's in which paper. But there was such a great deal to learn about what we were expecting of these children and how we could try to help them as best as possible to do something which remains the most extraordinary process, really extraordinary process.
I'm interested to know more about Sammy and what you learnt from him as a clinician.
Well, I learned to appreciate the strengths that can be there even in such a little boy. And he was a very endearing and sweet little boy when he wasn't driving me mad because he was so unpredictable. He was a child who your heart really did go out to because it was all up front. And his foster mother, who he'd been living with for half his life when it was coming to the point of moving to adoption, she really loved him. And she and he came together at the start of each session to fill me in on what had been going on during the week. Or in between sessions, something I'd not done before, but I felt I needed to know that. But I think the thing that was most striking was that when it came to we'd worked hard on trying to contain and understand a lot of what he was feeling about these three sets of parents he had in his mind, the birth parents, the foster parents, and these adoptive parents who were going to come into his life, but he didn't know when. But when it actually came to the events themselves, and it got closer and closer to the point where the adoptive parents had been identified and the matching was going on between the adoptive parents and the child, it was utterly overwhelming to try and contemplate what on earth it would be like to go through that kind of life experience. And I really, really genuinely thought, well, how on earth can I help with this whole process? And what was so remarkable for me to see was that the therapy up until that point had clearly prepared much more ground than I realised, that he found his own way. And I learned from that. He found his own way through creating what I've talked about as therapeutic transitional objects, with this green ball that he sort of suddenly became so attached to in the midst of all this growing tension, which was not spoken about directly to him, but he must have sensed in all the adults around him. He suddenly sort of attached himself to this ball in a way that was quite new and felt he had to take that ball home with him. And whilst there have been lots of battles about him wanting to take this, that and the other, and battles of control, this was entirely different, and I could immediately sense that. And I went with it. So I thought, well, let's see what happens. And the fact that this ball became so important to him, going in between the session and then home, and then he would bring it back to the next session, and the in-betweenness of that ball, and the fact that he also spent a lot of time sitting on the stairs at that point. He was just, it made me think of that, is it A.A. Milne, sitting on the stairs, there's a Winnie the Pooh story or something like that. He was absolutely in between, such a no man's land, such a desperate place. And yet this ball sustained him. And it belonged to both of us, but it didn't really just belong to either of us. And it was like a teddy. It was like a teddy that helped to link these two different places at that point between therapy and his foster home, but later on and in his mind between his foster home and his adoptive home. And alongside that, you know, when I realised, because I said when he could take the ball, as long as you bring it back, thinking, will he bring it back? Maybe not at all. But when he did bring it back, the fact that this ball then moved between us and helped to sustain him. And he also started to play in ways he hadn't played before, which I found extraordinary. There was something developmentally which was spurred by these actions. But I think because he was held very firmly by a very good social worker, a loving foster home, the therapy that was trying to explore these deeper issues. And so he was in a way sort of carried across this very treacherous sort of place in his life where he was very frightened of what was going to happen, and at the same time longing for some sort of security, also very hurt and rejected that he couldn't stay with his foster family, couldn't understand what had happened to his birth family. And he was only four. He even started school in the midst of this and managed somehow well. I mean, so it really impressed on me the strengths that were there if they were given a chance to flourish. So I learned an enormous amount from him. Attachment and loss and separation and mourning and playing and transitional phenomena, they were all being expressed through the work with him. So it was really very important to me.
You say about play being so important. Can you say more about that? When do you see signs in play that give you hope that there is a developmental shift?
I mean, the fact that it happens at all quite often, because you know that so often children really cannot play, not in a creative, free-flowing way. They may play in a repetitive sort of way or a ritualised sort of way, but they can't be creatively free and spontaneous in their play in the way that we very readily take for granted. You know, we see, you know, children playing together or playing on their own, and it's something that's very readily, with the achievement of playing and the different stages in getting to that place are very important to note. So I suppose that it was probably firstly again through him, although I always knew that play was important in my training, it was the interpretation of the meaning of that play. I then began to realise that play in itself was a process. The fact that somebody can play at all and how do we learn to play, that moved more to the fore. And noting the beginning little signs of that seemed to be one of the most important things we could help these children to do, because without being able to play, they had no means to communicate what they were feeling. It was as if they lacked the language that is the ordinary language of childhood.
We know as child psychotherapists how important play is as part of the therapy. What are the signs that you look out for when you see a developmental shift in the child and their play?
Well, I think there are sort of many little stages, many little steps. Playing doesn't come as a complete entity at all. And I think one of the things that sort of heralds that you're moving towards a new stage is what I really came to appreciate and what Winnicott's talking about in terms of being alone in the presence of someone. It's that point at which, in ordinary development, from our baby observation, we can often see how a child will be able to play, a baby, I mean, we're talking, you know, 9, 12 months, play it in an age-appropriate way, as long as the mother is there. If the mother goes out of the room beyond a certain period of time, that playing stops immediately. And yet, it's playing in the presence of somebody. It's not that the mother is involved with the play or prompting the play. It's the fact of the mother being there and being able to be alone in the presence of the mother in that instance that helps play to be sustained. Now, very quiet moments like that may just gradually begin to seep into the therapy. And now I spot them straight away. It took me a long while to recognise it. I mean, with my supervisee, it took me a long while to recognise it with my patients. But then I realised that those were like little oases that grew, so that the period of time at which a child could be absorbed in that playing would gradually grow. And so it was the process which interested me. You would get obviously interesting content in terms of the fantasies and the play itself, but the capacity to play is something which many children in these very neglected, traumatized histories have never had that experience of, because their parents, for all sorts of reasons, have not been able to be available to the child in that way. And it does happen in therapy. That's, you know, this idea of the quiet presence of the therapist. And it may only happen in little bits. A lot of the time you're chasing a child around the room and down the corridors and stopping them from doing things, but there are those precious times, and when they happen they need to be nurtured. They really need to have the attention given to them, because then they grow into something more. And with that playing, then some fundamental issues can be expressed which couldn't be expressed otherwise by a child. I mean, again, with Sammy, there's that bit of material when he's playing with baking. He's baking a cake. This is just literally at the point he's about, and he must have known that in some part of him. You know, within a day or two, I knew he was going to be told his adopted parents had been found. And here's this very impulsive little boy, very physical little boy, who is by that point, and it had come quite suddenly in a way, able to play in the sandpit, pretending that he's baking cakes, and I'm able to sit and watch. So there you have the, you know, alone in the presence of another playing experience. So he doesn't need me to be involved. He's not doing anything that he shouldn't do. He's really genuinely playing, making cakes. And then, and this is in the midst of me thinking, I don't know how this, how can he possibly put all these experiences together? In the midst of that, he's making his cakes, and then he comes and sits down next to me very quietly and says, shh, now we have to wait. I mean, this is a child who you'd think is incapable of waiting. And I suddenly realised that what he was talking about also was having to wait. You couldn't take a cake out of the oven until it was ready. And the same with what he was doing with waiting to hear about an adoptive family amidst all the ambivalence to do with it. And it was incredibly moving. Now, I couldn't have said or done anything like that would have prompted that. This came from within him, because it had been facilitated by what was going on around him. There had been a great deal of thought about what's the wisest way to introduce him to his adoptive parents, how much time was required, how to plan the meetings, but a lot of adult concern. And I think that helped to carry him so that he could go to those steps and he could wait, which was quite amazing. And I could say that to him just in a simple sentence, that maybe just in the same way, he knows that this can't be hurried and that, you know, he'll have to wait, but that it's being attended to, it's cooking, it's on its way, but very, very moving, all through play. Now, I wouldn't have found a way of putting that into words, and there are often times like that with children where they come with the metaphor, they have a capacity for a poetic appreciation, which blows you away. Where does that come from? It's extraordinary.
I'm interested in how you've developed your theoretical background to your thinking in child psychotherapy. And I know that most of your training at the Tavistock was focused on the work of Melanie Klein. And you've since become known as an independent child psychotherapist. So I'm interested in what independent child psychotherapists, what their theoretical background is and how their work might differ from those who perhaps adhere more to a Kleinian background?
Well, I think the biggest thing is in technical issues and in how one thinks about the impact of the external world on the internal world. I think that in many ways, because I always worked outside Northwest London. I did my training and everything in Chelmsford, where there certainly was some psychoanalytic understanding, but it would have been at that point in the 70s, these sort of ideas were not a currency in the general thinking that was around at the time. And so because of that, I had a sort of, you know, possibility of thinking more freely about what I felt was really impacting on a child. My training cases, certainly one of them was a little boy who was in a special care baby unit very soon after birth. And the impact of that external experience on the problems he brought with feeding problems was utterly apparent. You couldn't separate the two. So I was always very conscious of the real external world. And I think that's one of the things that distinguishes an independent approach. I mean, I think an Anna Freudian approach also has that very much in it. But Anne Horn and I co-edited, there's this book series, an independent series that we've co-edited. And the first book that we did when we got together as a group with a group of other writers was called A Question of Technique. Because it seemed that that was really where one of the biggest differences lay, particularly around issues of whether to play or not, or how to play or not with a child, how and when to interpret, how and in what ways to work with the parents or the environment around the child. And we realised, we all sort of, we had a meeting and we went away and then sort of all tried to do our bits of writing. We didn't quite know what was going to come out of this, because we wanted to do exactly as you're saying, establish what do we mean by an independent way of working, independent psychoanalytic way of working. And we all came back full of Winnicott, which really surprised, which shouldn't have surprised us, but Winnicott particularly didn't want to establish a school. He was very against a doctrinaire thing. And I think what I find so helpful with Winnicott is that you can take his ideas and they grow in all sorts of different directions. And we've clearly all been doing that in different ways in our work. So our understanding of what Winnicottian views about good enough parents, about a facilitating environment, about ordinary development, all of that came together there. So that's very core thinking, but it's very much more than that. You know, it's also really, how does one understand the impact of the external world on each one of us individually, and how it differs, and how do we then help a child who is actually struggling with the impact that the external world has had on them, trying to make sense of it, trying to understand it, and trying to bear the distress. Again, it's also very much about containment.
And that reminds me of something you say about psychoanalysis, that despite all the high thinking in theory, and we've been doing a bit of that today, you've also said that actually the devoted attention of the psychotherapist with the child replicates that of a good ordinary parent.
Yes, and I think, I mean, that links a bit to Anne Hurry's ideas about the developmental object, which I think is there in the current relationship between the therapist and the child, as opposed to the transference aspect of that total relationship that is going on between them. But I think that what we're doing differently is that there are very different boundaries around that, because these are children, the foster and adopted children, who are getting good care, but are often not able to avail themselves of it sufficiently. So we have to be able to find a way of moving between understanding what stands in the way of that, which is to do with the past and the transference aspects of what's in the relationship with the foster and adoptive parents or with ourselves, and those other moments where developmental care is going in and is helping a child to move forward. And I think that particularly when one's thinking about neglect, which only has become more apparent to me, and really particularly since supervising a lot of cases of children like this, is that it's very striking, the detail of observation and experience and a feeling that is there with supervisees. And this is training, people in training who, you know, I have the greatest admiration for, the detail with which they observe, which they've learned anyway from baby observation, but not just observed, feel, notice, not just, you know, with the child's environment and everything else as well. And this is very reminiscent of a parent's absorption, the ordinary parent's absorption, with the tiny details of what is going on with their baby. The sort of things that people other than parents just get bored to death of hearing about. But parents notice all those little details. And that is exactly what the therapist is doing in that particular hour. They are not obviously the parent, but they are doing something which reaches back to a stage which actually it's very, very hard to reach otherwise. There's something which comes into the relationship with the therapist at that point where those, particularly those training patients, people do remember all of their lives. And it's also there actually when I'm writing particular patients, you know, past beyond the training case patients, where the detail of it stays with you. So that it's very genuine when you say to your patients, you know, that they think you're just going to forget about them. You really don't. You know, it does stay with you. It does stay with you in many ways.
And what you say about neglected children, I know that you are very careful to make a distinction between the children who've been neglected and the children who've been abused. Could you elaborate more on what those differences are that you see in those children?
Well, they often go together, of course, you know, and I think it's the fact that neglect opens the door to trauma and to abuse, because neglect is so much more pervasive. When one looks, again, from what we've seen, we observe all the time through baby observation and just around us in our own experiences with children, in our own children and seeing other family members, or just ordinarily sitting in a cafe and watching a family together. The attention to detail that's going on at that point has not happened. So you're talking about if there's a baby that is born into a family that may start off with many good intentions to do it differently. And I say a family, sadly, often it's the single mother, but it could be both parents, who become overwhelmed by what actually is really required from them as a parent. They haven't got the resources within themselves. And we all struggle with feeling we haven't got enough resources, you know, with the best of the wind behind us and family around us and you know, no immediate traumatic events around the time of the birth. We all struggle as parents to meet the needs of a child. Now, if you've got a family who have are living in with not enough money, unemployment, who may be addicted to drugs or alcohol, who maybe have had many traumas in their own growing up, who have probably not been well enough parented, they're very quickly, within a week or so, are going to feel overwhelmed and exhausted. And when that happens, they can go in various different directions. And what then begins to happen is that the baby's needs are not heard. I mean, it's Selma Freyberg's work as well. The baby's cries are not responded to or not thought about carefully enough. Why is this baby crying? Why is my baby crying now? Now, for a parent who's already overloaded, the temptation to ignore those cries or to just keep doing the same thing in the hope it will help, of not allowing themselves or not being able to try to imagine what the baby needs now. I mean, often in baby observation and just observation generally of parents with children, parents at the beginning of their baby's life spend an enormous amount of time and energy talking to the baby and saying, now, is it you've got an upset tummy? Do I need to change your nappy? Maybe that particular solid that I've tried to introduce you to isn't right. Maybe it's too hot. Maybe it's too cold. Look at the detail there. Now, parents who are very troubled and already close to being overloaded can't do that. And that is happening all the time. So we're not just talking about the physical neglect that is adjusted. It's not adjusted at all. But, you know, the fact that the baby may cry for hours and not get fed because the parents, for various reasons, can't. Or the baby may have a very sore bottom and the nappy isn't being changed because the parents can't bear to hear any more crying. We're talking beyond that. That's the Winnicottian physical holding that he sees as being so important. We're talking about that as being the substance of their life all the time. It may sometimes reach a level where it is somewhat better, but then it's likely to sink again because these parents without sufficient support, that's where parent-infant psychotherapy is so important, but without sufficient support, they really can't do it. So there's a sort of been a substandard kind of response to the child from the word go, and into that, potential abusers find a way because they can come in all sorts of ways, sometimes very clearly grooming the child and the parents by, oh, I'll babysit, I'll help out with this and that, because the parents are so grateful for that at that point. The child isn't protected. You know, this is Bowlby. The child is not protected from the dangers that are there for babies at that stage. You know, we're utterly dependent on the protection of parents at that stage. So that in terms of physical care and accidents, there won't be enough attention to that. The door is opened through neglect. And of course, you can have neglect across the social strata. You know, you can have a child who's emotionally neglected, who's being brought up by nannies and by nurseries and by all sorts of well-heeled middle-class and upper-class trappings. And yet emotionally, their life is very impoverished. So, I mean, there are different levels, but the fact is that the responses to the needs, the detailed individual needs of the child, are not, they're not being met in the responses around them, not by the parents and often inadequately by other people. And then you have a very deprived, emotionally deprived, empty kind of person.
I'm interested in those cases where there's been severe multiple complex losses. And for children who have been taken into care, mourning the loss of a parent is much more complex, isn't it? Because often the parent is still alive. And maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, about the mourning process that children can go through the use of child psychotherapy.
Well, I think often the mourning, inevitably the mourning process is impeded, you know, in the classical sort of way. And what we get more than anything is the anger that we associate with these different stages of mourning that Bowlby and Murray Parks have talked about. So we get a great deal of the anger and bewilderment as well about what has happened. We get a certain amount of searching for the lost object, which I think it's easy to miss. Sometimes a child will be obviously pining for their biological parent, who may well be idealised, or who may well be in tragic circumstances themselves. For example, if there are mental health issues, physical health issues, you know, or the parent may have died. The child is pining for that adult, but it doesn't show clearly because the pain, again, is something which is reacted against and comes out in a much more angry, difficult sort of way. And children who have been moved away from their biological parents for the multitude of reasons and often in very traumatic circumstances, that, you know, there's the actual removal of the child from the family home, which is one set of terribly traumatic, shocking experiences for the child. But there's also all the build-up to that and the fact that the parent may have been able to be a good enough parent some of the times, but then when drugged or when depressed is unable to be. All the individual circumstances, it's an enormously complex task. It's not the same as children where parents are separated or divorced, but there is a similarity in knowing that you can't see one or other of the parents where there have been terrible custody battles. And yet, you know, that parent's down the road. Why can't you see them? A sense of rejection and pain from all of that is enormous. And adults need at least a year to get over a fairly ordinary, expectable kind of mourning the death of a parent. When children go into care, they lose so much. They lose the biological parents and sometimes the biological extended family for a variety of reasons. And they may lose their school. They obviously lose their home. They may lose a number of important toys and possessions, including transitional objects, special teddies and things that don't come with them. And there's no opportunity to mourn one of those, let alone all of them. And they're with strangers. One of the things, again, that we know helps anybody if they're mourning is that they have somebody who is with them during that period, who accompanies them in a way through that mourning, who tries to support them. And we see that going on around us all the time. Somebody who's known to you usually well beforehand, not somebody who's new to you. These children go to a completely new family, often a very understanding and remarkable family in terms of what they're actually doing, but they don't have that. So that there are many things against their being able to begin to mourn and to feel sad. That's one of the things that happens in therapy and particularly can come up more when there's a planned ending, a good way off, because there you have the opportunity of preparatory mourning as a therapeutic relationship. And alongside that, there's a stimulation of past losses so that other memories of sad losses begin to come more to the fore. So somewhat paradoxically, people often, quite understandably, particularly if it's too soon, are very concerned as to how on earth can you stop seeing a child like this in therapy? How can you bring it to an end? Big dilemma. And sometimes it's too soon and it's for reasons of funding and all sorts of things we're contending with in the NHS. But often there's a point where you feel this child has come a good way and is quite a going concern now and is developing. But to give the child and the family and the school, because they all become very dependent on knowing the child is going to therapy, to give the child a period of time to think about this and to be able to explore the feelings about it as therapy is moving towards an end is very, very valuable. And things begin to emerge then which have not been stimulated to the same extent before. I mean, holidays and weekend breaks and things will stimulate thoughts about loss and about being forgotten in many ways. But a therapy coming to an end is a very different matter. And we all know, we've all heard of kids or had kids who have said, I'm coming to see you till I'm 29, and things like that, you know. But who do then gradually become able to accept that this can't go on forever. And also that life has to be about a flow. And I think that's really important with working with children, that many things, when a child is beginning to recover, make for a good growing up. And you have to be able to let go of one thing to be able to move on to the next. So endings are also beginnings. Without that being about a denial, it's another paradox, it's another transition. And if you can't let go, then you can't move on. And it's as straightforward as that. And as therapists, we've got to be able to judge when that is possible. Fight for extra therapy if it's not, but to do the best we can to create a really as helpful an ending as possible, because of the mourning that then can take place on so many different levels.
Monica, you ask in your latest book, Transforming Despair to Hope, how much recovery is really possible in such damaged internal and external lives? What can we hope for, do you think?
Well, I think this is where I come back to Winnicottian ideas. We can hope to live as creatively as we possibly can, despite the hardships that we have to contend with, all of us in life, and these children particularly so. And I think also what can come into this is a greater sense of gratitude for the fact that it is possible for life to become richer. And it can become richer through relationships, it can become richer through arts, through creative experiences altogether. I think an appreciation of life can come through despite all of these things. And I always go back to thinking of people who have suffered in so many ways through the wars, and people who are refugees, and how despite the most dreadful things that they often are quite unable to talk about or refuse to talk about for good reasons, they've managed to make a life. And I often find this quite amazing. So it's not that you can put right, you can't get rid of these awful events that have taken place, but you can maybe enable people to make the most of and to be open for what is there for them in the present. I mean, that's one of the things we're doing very much, that, you know, that it's often bewildering to people who think, well, why on earth this child has come from this awful environment, they're now living with this lovely family, all these great things are happening, what's the matter with them? Why are they still so difficult, so troubled, so hard to live with? I think you can help them to be able to avail themselves of those good things that are there for them in life. And that kind of awareness and living creatively, you know, I'm trying to think what I mean by living creatively. I think it's about living with an appreciation of the world around you. I was wanting to say living with joy, and that seems a long way from where many of these children are when we're seeing them. But there are joyous moments, there are beautiful moments with some of these children in therapy where suddenly something makes sense, which is often very touching with a child, when you might have made an interpretation which you weren't sure about, but which really a child appreciates, and they give you a hug, you know, which is very moving, you know, that I think that kind of emotional contact that takes place, that's all possible, but you can't get rid of all these things that have happened. You can help people to live with it, because we know that people right on into old age, they carry these things and they're doing the best they can with them. But the more there's gratitude and awareness of the good things in life, the more they'll be able to cope. And it's very striking when you hear some people who have been, for example, Holocaust survivors, who despite all of that, and I'm sure because they had a good start in life, currently refugees and asylum seekers as well, young people, that despite all of that, I'm thinking about older Holocaust survivors, who will say, I've been very fortunate in life. And it's not denial. They're actually fortunate, they feel, because they're alive, because they actually, after the horrors of what they went through, they managed to find somebody and have a love relationship and to have a family. Now, that's pretty miraculous as far as I'm concerned, but you can't get rid of what happened to them in those years before. That will always be there in some part of the personality, maybe encapsulated in some way, but it'll always be there.
This work with traumatised children takes a huge amount out of us as child psychotherapists. And yet you've written a lot about how we as therapists really need to sustain ourselves. What are your thoughts about that?
I learnt by hard experience, I think, to start with, because it's very easy to burn out in this work. And I think one can almost feel guilty to come to the end of a working day and be able to go home to a good enough family life, to be financially secure, to be able to put it down. You can almost feel guilty about that. And I think it's, and also because the work gets so inside you and has to be processed in some way, I think there are inevitably times when it's very, very much with you when you go home and in your dreams and over the weekends. You know, if a child and family are going through desperate times, I think you need to be able to do some of that processing, but you also need to be able to look after yourself. So I think simple things, which often don't happen, and I've been very much a part of that, not taking a lunch break because you've got to keep going, and then you're so tired, or at least I would get so tired, that I couldn't really be properly available to patients because I was knackered. Not keeping fit, not eating wisely, not replenishing yourself, not taking the full holidays, working too much over the weekends with notes and with reading and stuff. Too serious and heavy. You need something that is on the other side. And I suppose that's, so you need interests, you need music, you need gardening, sports, theatre, drama. It's really important to have that kind of balance, because otherwise you see too many people, sadly, who do burn out, who become very ill. And I suppose it was whilst I was running the training in Scotland, I became very aware of how it was very likely that at some point during the training, each and every one of the trainees would go through some ordinary family crisis on top of all the work they were trying to carry, and how important it was to say, you've got to take time off. You know, we're not allowed to be ill. You know, you've got to take time off. And if you don't take the time off now, it's going to be worse in the long run. So the self-care, and we often need, and I'm still the same in many ways, somebody who says to you, it's enough, you've got to stop. But what also I felt had been very important is for me, has been that I've many years ago began to meditate and was fortunate to meet somebody who could really help me and who came from a background where she understood, she knew a great deal about psychoanalysis and had her own analysis, but she also had this additional awareness, which I hesitate now to use the word spiritual because it's changed in its meaning, but which through meditating and through what she taught me, and it was a Sufi kind of meditation, but very much the practicalities, not the intellectual. I know very little about Sufism in that sort of respect, but the value of meditating and how that calmed me, helped me to focus, to be in the present moment. Sufi meditation is very much about opening the heart. And that, of course, is very relevant for this work, but opening the heart in a practical and advised sort of way. So meditation has been a part of my life, more or less at different stages, more if there are difficult things going on, less in more everyday things. It too often gets squashed out of my life. But it's been there for well over 35 years, and I've certainly found that it became very important when I had a day where I knew there were one or two or more difficult patients that I felt anxious about seeing. We all feel that at times. That if I managed to meditate in the morning or sometimes just before the session, I lowered my anxiety rate. I felt that the child would come to a very different physical and emotional space as a result of that. And I was able to contain and cope much better with the work. So there's, for me, the regularity of that, as much as I'm able to sustain it, and particularly the fact that I can go back to it, very available. It's there in that paper about meditation and transitional states that's in Transforming Despair to Hope, that it's a place you can go back to very readily, and it's a real refuge for me. And in fact, there were, through this, I hadn't realised it was something you didn't talk about. You sort of almost had to come out about 10 years ago. I was talking with a supervisee, somebody I'd known for many years, very experienced therapist, who was going through a very stressed time at her work with cuts and difficult patients and many distressing things. And I sort of somewhat hesitantly sort of said, you know, what would really help you with something like this, where have you ever meditated? And she said, oh yes, for years, you know. So we knew each other very well, hadn't spoken about this aspect as something very important to our own personal lives and ourselves. And as a result of that, we set up a series of workshops on psychotherapy and meditation, where many people that we'd both known for many years and others had been meditating for a long while, it had been helping them, but kept in separate boxes. And I think that's unfortunate. I think the two can go very well together, and really that meditation is an enormously helpful way of trying to calm our inner space. And of course, there's so much research about this now because of all the brain research. But even just 10 years ago, saying something like this and setting up this workshop was considered very bold, which was really quite surprising, you know, and it wasn't such a bold thing at all. We discovered a great deal through that. So I think people have got to have that resource to replenish them, because otherwise it's actually quite a dangerous profession. You know, people can break down, people can become physically ill, and I don't know that there are any statistics or anything on this, but for a small profession, I think we do have casualties when we don't pay enough attention to these matters. It may be entirely wrong, but I have that impression.
And would you encourage child psychotherapists to share with colleagues if they're feeling unbearable distress?
Oh, yes. And in supervision, you know, quite often people will be in tears, you know, because of something moving, because of something painful, because of something desperately worrying. But at one point when I was thinking a lot about this and I still feel it, you know, that almost felt that there should be something in our training which says, you know, we've got so many hours of this and so many hours of that we have to do. I think there should be so many hours of something that really nourishes you as a part of our training. I think it should be built in. I mean, yoga, I think, is very important. Many people get a great deal from that. Yoga and Pilates, but generally physical things. We're terribly in our heads, not enough in our bodies. Or at least maybe less so now, but in the past that was the case. So I almost feel that in our training, we should have something where we show, and with our CPD things, you know, what we do. What do we do for our relaxation? Because I think we have to have that kind of input as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a yoga teacher as well as a child psychotherapist, and I found actually having a physical practice is really important. Yes. And also for identifying when you can see in patients that there is a bodily response to distress. Oh, yes. And noticing that in yourself physically as well.
Yes, I mean, I think that's really interesting. I mean, you'd understand a great deal more about that than I do. But I do yoga, not particularly brilliantly, but I do it. Again, attention to detail is fascinating to me. And the fact that my mind at that point really disengages with everything else. And that's so good for me. And I don't know how to work with, and I know there are some specific trainings that work with the physical aspects, how people are feeling pain, where they're feeling pain in their body. I don't know enough about that, but I have a great respect for the potential to help people where things are too, just have landed in their body. And I'm sure that has an impact on physical well-being and health. You know, these things, we've noted some of these things psychoanalytically, but I don't think we've known what to do with it.
Our work as child psychotherapists, I think, is getting increasingly difficult with social services cuts and also the dislocation of families. There's increasing trauma that children are experiencing. And I'm wondering how you feel child psychotherapy should respond to this as to how to best treat children in the face of that.
I think we've got to be very careful about how we, I don't like the word assessment, how we decide which children and families we should be seeing, because there are a variety of treatments available. I think the downside of that is that we therefore tend to get the most difficult and complex cases, and people can use that as a way of saying, well, look, they don't make much difference because we've not had long enough to work with a child. But I think in some respects, if you like, each meeting of the network around a child is an opportunity to share some of our knowledge and understanding of a child with the network that often is inadequately supported in different ways. So as well as the work in the consulting room, there's work with fellow professionals, which I think we should be doing, but not in a preachy sort of way. I think we have to choose carefully those children that we see. I mean, weekly now is seen as a luxury for some children. But we have to choose carefully in terms of how far we can go with them, depending on the support that is there for the therapy and the readiness to change that is there within the family, whether it's foster and adoptive parents or biological family. A readiness in the schools often to be open to seeing a child in a different frame, in a different way. And quite a number of child psychotherapists now, quite a few training cases and others I'm aware of are taking place in the school, where a school is very supportive. And I think that is very helpful because you're bringing together these containing networks. And for the parents who may be struggling, whatever, again, it makes a lot of practical difference if this child is seen at school rather than travelling backwards and forwards. Those things matter. But I think we have to know we can be most effective is really the point. And then I think we have to really argue. I don't know, that's the wrong word, maybe. We have to insist that some children need much more time than people are saying we can give to them. And it seems to me that we must say that. And if we're nevertheless, you know, what we're saying is not listened to, we have to register through whatever kind of levels of management we can, our concern about that and how this is inadequate treatment. So I think we have to be somewhat prepared to really insist on knowing what we do know about the consequences of having to stop treatment too soon or of not being able to offer enough treatment. We have to speak out about these things. So, I mean, firstly, in our own clinical practice, and often things will happen that we don't like, but we can register it. It can be some, and I don't know where anymore in the current system this should go to, but it should be within the system somewhere that it is known that this was not enough for this child and this family. It should be on record. And I think, similarly, you know, I appreciate the way in which the ACP is really trying more to make, through the media, people more aware of these issues, because there's all this lip service to the need to improve child and adolescent mental health and adult mental health services, which infuriates me, because meanwhile, things are being, the actual on the ground experience is that it's less and less, and that the idea that there can be quick fixes for increasingly complex problems is just, it's a dreadful waste of resources because they can't go anywhere and they're being spread too thin. So, I mean, as you can tell, I have strong feelings about it because I hear, I mean, there are a few clinics. I hear about lots of clinics in different parts of the country. One or two of them actually are doing very well because of a lot of hard work that has gone on with within the trust. There are good relationships within the trust. But there are so many more where people are constantly faced with terrible injustices. And that, I think, is really hard to bear. And that can get people in terms of stress, sometimes more than the actual work itself, because of the sense of injustice and the sense that this child and family could be getting something, but they're not because of decisions being made elsewhere.
But of course, the ending of therapy must come at some point for children. And it's something you've been giving an awful lot of thought to, haven't you?
Yes, and I wish I'd been better at it earlier on in my work, because I don't think I gave enough attention to it. And I think that at the time that I was training, therapies went on for a very long while. And talking about endings was an absolute rarity in my training, in many years at the TAVI. And I think the attention to endings maybe is being forced on us more because of these issues of having to really think carefully about allocation of resources. So in a way, that's pushed us to thinking, well, when is the right, what is a good enough ending, basically? What, you know, which children can benefit from shorter periods of time, which really need to go on for longer? And I think that endings provide the opportunity for all sorts of past losses that it's been very, very hard to mourn, to surface again under the pressure of knowing that the child has to leave the therapist, that it's coming to an end. But you need lots of time for that, so that you can have a planned ending, or as good a planned ending as you can manage. Sometimes that's very difficult, and it might just be a very abrupt ending, particularly with adolescents. But quite often it is possible to extend it somewhat, something which stops a traumatic cut and gives, again, a transition between ending therapy and a new life that goes forward from that. And I place a lot of importance on that now, because I think the child and the family have the chance to anticipate, it's anticipatory mourning, to prepare themselves in some ways, to express to the therapist their disappointment and their anger that this can't go on forever, their recognition that although this is a very intimate relationship, it nevertheless has to end. That's a reality. I mean, Nina Coulthard is wonderful about this. She talks about how we build this intense relationship where we really are so close to the patient. And then she says something rather like, and then what do? We end it. I mean, it seems so bizarre in many ways. And I remember one little girl who hated me when she first came to see me. She hated coming 3 times a week. We had a great palaver with her all the time to get her into the room. Towards the end of her therapy, when I introduced the idea that we were going to, you know, that there would be an ending, it would be coming to an end, she was so upset. She said, but why should I stop when I'm just enjoying it? You know, everything else, dancing, ballet, all the, you know, you don't stop when you're, so it's very counterintuitive. And I think it highlights that this is a professional relationship, however close and intimate you've been. And there is the opportunity to express those feelings towards the therapist whilst the therapist is still there. If it stops abruptly, that's often repetition of a traumatic break in some way in the past. And you have to do everything you can, even if it's just something very small in terms of simply sending a letter to an adolescent who has just refused to come, to keep on trying to get that adolescent to come at least for one farewell session. Anything that doesn't repeat, I think the problem with endings is that it can often repeat traumatic endings of the past, and you're trying to create an ending or to give the opportunity for an ending to take place, which is very different to endings in the past. And we see all of these things, you know, actually now there's much more awareness of transitions and changes. I'm thinking about transitions from primary to secondary school. Great deal of work that goes on in many primary schools to prepare these children who are the oldest and the most mature and responsible in the primary school, give them their responsibilities as that in that position, but to enable them also to prepare to look forward to going into the secondary schools and the length between primary and secondary schools to enable that transition to take place. Help those children who are feeling very sad, some of them, about leaving primary school and going into secondary school. And maybe in some ways with all the farewell things that happen during that year, might help some of those kids who are raring to go into secondary school and who can't wait to grow up to just temper that a little bit with an awareness of some of the what you're leaving behind, the growing up part of it. So endings have got great significance. How? Because they're also beginnings. They're always or some sort of beginning of something new. And to potentiate that newness as much as possible of the past needs to have been thought about, but also to some extent let go of. So you're going from holding your patience as firmly as you can and as reliably as you can to letting go of them. Now that's hard, but that's parenting again. Absolutely parenting, you know, sort of parents with their teenagers who are about to leave home or go off to uni, you know, are enormously exercise by thinking, have I done a good enough job? Will they be okay? Will they be okay without me? Meanwhile, the teenagers just want the parents to leave them alone and let them go. It's very complex to separate in that way. It's very complex, but it's part of life.
Well, we must end there. I feel like one of those children that is finding it difficult to say goodbye because I've enjoyed talking with you so much. Thank you very much for your time, Annika. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Mind in Mind and to Monica Laniardo. Each week we're adding more interviews, blogs and research from leading clinicians around the world. Mind in Mind is here to support the work of everyone working therapeutically with children. Go to mindinmind.org.uk and sign up for our newsletter.